There aren't many artists who have the talent and good fortune to join a small studio and then grow with the organization, but Carlos Saldana is one of the chosen few. Born in Rio de Janeiro, Carlos commenced drawing at a tender age, but he realized early on that the animation business was more robust north of the equator than in Brazil. So Mr. Saldana journeyed to New York City, where he enrolled at the School of Visual Arts and focused on computer graphics and animation. At the end of his time there, he had two well-received short films, The Adventures of Corky the Corkscrew and Time for Love. Also, an invitation from SVA instructor Chris Wedge to join a small fledgling studio named Blue Sky. Starting as an animator and director on commercials and shorts, Mr. Saldana has now directed on 5 Blue Sky features, the most recent of which, Rio, was released in the spring of last year. We spoke on Friday, January 6th, 2012. Talking today with Carlos Saldana, who is the director and father of Rio and all the characters therein. So, Carlos, my question is, when you started to get interested in animation, were you still in Rio? Or, I mean, did you say, this is something that I've got to get into? Or what, did you just sort of evolve into it when you came to the States?
Well, I wanted to do that. At first, I always loved to draw since I was a kid. I always liked drawing. I always liked comics. I liked cartoons. And I loved animation and movies in general, and I loved to draw. But that was, for me, that was kind of like a hobby, a pastime that I had.
Yeah, yeah.
Growing up. Finally, when I, you know, after I finished high school and all that, and I wanted to think about a career, like a job, that wasn't in the what was natural to do, you know, because, like, you know, people still perceived art as not being a job and not being more like a hobby, not so much of a profession in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially back in Brazil. So I decided to venture into computer, you know, computer science. So, like, I started to learn about computers. I enjoyed computers. I enjoyed programming and all that. But then as I went deeper into that, I started to feel there was something missing. And for me, what was missing was the creative side of the art part of it that I always loved. And that's when I started to tap into seeing stuff in computer graphics. I started to get interested in special effects, watching movies, you know, and seeing what's happening with computer animation. Got me excited to try that out. But back then, we were talking about, you know, late 80s. It was not very, you know, it wasn't readily available in Brazil. That stuff was kind of like mostly happening, even in its early stages, was happening in the U.S.
Right.
So that's when I kind of like did a lot of research in terms of places that I could go or that I could learn or I could be involved with that. Not there were not many options, but then New York came up to my mind, and as a friend of a friend of a friend recommended this school, like School of Visual Arts in New York, that had an animation program. And I said, well, that could be interesting, but, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be good at it. I don't know if I'm going to have what it takes to be an animator. But I decided to go anyway. So when I was 21, you know, at that age, that you kind of like not afraid of doing anything. So I just packed my bags. I got married, actually. I proposed to my fiancée at the time, saying, like, let's get married and go to New York and see what happens. And in that crazy kind of things that, you know, impulsive things that we do when we're young, we just came to New York.
Hmm. And was it always going to be New York? I mean, because there was the only other option I could think of at the time would have been Cal Arts.
Yeah, definitely. But everything converged to New York for me. You know, it was easier access. You know, I happened to know a couple of people in New York. So it was for me felt like. And since I didn't know if I was going to stay or if I'm going to succeed, I said, like, let's start there and see how it flows from there. Because I also, even back then, I wasn't so much aware of, like, Cal Arts and the other schools. Like, I went for the one that was recommended by this guy that I met. I saw the catalog. I liked what they were offering. It was an early new program that I thought that would be interesting to get into. But it was more like that kind of, like, naive adventure of just trying it out, like exploring the world a little bit. And then we came to New York, and the thing about it is, like, when I arrived in New York and I went to the first class at school, at the time was a continuing education class. I was I sat in the computer, and then we start to play around with the graphics and with the software, and I fell in love with it. I said, wow, this is what I want to do. This is definitely, I found a way that I could combine my computer skills, which I didn't want to waste. I loved it, and with the things that are playing in my head. And I felt that that would be the right medium for me to be an artist, to explore myself as an artist. But the class that I was taking, I was prepared to stay in New York only for 4 months.
Yeah.
Or less. But then I was so excited about the class, and I dedicated myself a lot to the class specifically. And then the teacher that was teaching me the class was like, you know, his name was Bruce Wands, and he was responsible for the recruiting for the master's program, which was a longer, more dedicated program on animation and computer graphics and all that. And he liked the stuff that I was doing. He felt that was passionate, and he said, like, why don't you stay longer in the U.S. and try to do something more serious, you know, like go beyond just the classes and just go to a master's program, to go to try an MFA.
Yeah, so you went for the full boat master's.
And then
of fine
I went
arts.
In, and I went in, I full force into that, and then it worked out for me because I loved it, and I got a chance there to meet Chris Wedge, which was one of the teachers, and we connected right away. I did a couple of shorts when I was doing the, you know, that's when I really discovered myself that I want to be a storyteller, that I want to be a storyteller through computer animation, that's what I wanted to do. So I created two shorts. The last one that I did, called Time for Love, was the one that I showed in many festivals. It traveled a little bit, and that was the one that got me people interested in my work and interested in what I could offer in terms of an animator, as a creative person.
Yeah.
And that's when I met Chris Wedge, and he said, look, we have this company called Blue Sky. We're very small. We only, a handful of people, then you could be one of our first animators, and you know, you have a chance to grow with us. If we grow, we have big dreams. We're small with big dreams. And I said, oh, that's what I want. And I went in full force with them as well, and then we started this, like, you know.
And you were one of the animators
growing until today.
You were one of the animators on Bunny, right? So
I was one of the animators, but when Bunny started, Bunny was one of those, like, you know, company-wide, you know, projects. Like, you know, Chris had that project in his head for the longest time, and he never, you know, because of work and all that, he never had a chance to execute it. And then finally, after a few years that I was at Blue Sky, we were able to carve out time for him to finish Bunny, as I would take over some of the directorial work with some commercials and some jobs we're taking just to keep the company going, you know.
Right.
So everybody worked on Bunny. Like, I was credited as an animator, did two scenes, but I have to say that not, you know, I wasn't like full force working on it. Everybody, you know, tapped into it. Everybody helped a little bit.
Yeah. So you were involved in. You never got into the hand. You were not one of these guys that was a hand-drawn animator that switched to CGI. You were in computers right from the beginning, right?
Right from the beginning, because, you know, I was in a certain disadvantage in terms of the drawing skills, because I never took any classes. I never went to art school. I never, like, all my drawings and my creative side of it, my artistic side of it, it was all very, in a way, you know, rough. You know, it was always something that I did because I had the talent and I liked doing it, but I never actually did it in a way that I found like some of a lot of guys do. You know, even when I went to art school, some of the people could draw like maniacs. They were amazing, and I couldn't keep up. So, but in the computer, I was really good. So I was able to use the computer as my canvas in a way that some other guys couldn't use. So I think that's where I found my niche. That's where I found what I was good at.
Yeah, it sounds like the computer was your sort of your canvas right from the beginning.
Right from now, the get-go, and that's where I felt the most comfortable with. And at the end of the day, that's what I, when I talk to students that wanted to do animation and all that, I keep saying, like, look, if you know how to draw, don't know how to draw, it's like, you know, it really matters only if you find what is the tool that you can use to express yourself creatively. So if it's the computer, it's great. If it's the pencil, it's awesome. If it's the oil and canvas, that's, you know, it's great. It's just you have to find what tools, how can you express the best your art, your artistic side.
You have to choose your tool and go with it.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, the computer doesn't do it by itself. It requires, like, an artist to play with. So
oh, yeah.
And just the same thing with a pencil, same thing everything with a brush.
And were you involved in story? It sounds like you were probably involved in the story side along with the animation side pretty much from the get-go. Is that true?
Yes, always with concepts, story, ideas. I always had tons of ideas, and my mind was always working that way. It wasn't just execution of the elements, but trying to coming up with concepts and thinking about creative approaches in terms of storytelling and into visuals, into everything. It was definitely not just execution. It was more like conceptualizing a lot of the elements that we had to work with.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm going to skip. I know that you were heavily involved and co-director of all the Ice Age epics and all of that stuff, but let's jump to Rio, since that's kind of the subject here of the interview. I know from research that you had the idea in the back of your head for quite a while.
Yeah, the thing about it is, like, I was coming from Brazil and then working on all these projects, I was starting to be surrounded by, you know, other people that did, you know, projects that involved, like, you know, let me start again. When we think about a movie or an idea to have, it's always we're looking for, like, what hasn't been done yet? What is something that I can connect with as an artist and express myself the best way? What are those ideas that hasn't been tapped yet? Or if they have been tapped, they haven't been done in the right way that you want it to be. And so I always had them back in my head. What is my original idea? What is the idea that, you know, it feels close to my heart? That's when I started to have thoughts about doing something with Rio, you know, it's something with Brazil, per se. Because, you know, being from there, I always felt there was such a rich culture, you know, music, color, you know, life, you know, could be an exciting place to be. And then I always felt that I personally never felt that I watched the movie that best expressed that kind of feeling that I had when I was, you know, when I watched a movie about my culture, my home country, or my hometown.
Oh, and there's no, you know, the only, and I was watching this just yesterday. You know, the only animation that I know of, you know, the widespread animation on Brazil and Rio is Saludos Amigos, and that's pretty. Looking at that after looking at Rio, which I looked at recently, I mean, it's like night and day. Because it's basically these American artists dropping in and going, oh,
yeah, no,
this and
that's
this
what he felt. You know, it's not only Brazil, you know, and that was a compilation of countries. It was about, you know, South America, Latin America in general, and Brazil was one of the subjects of the big thing. So I never felt that it went in depth enough, or, you know, I think that for the time, it was a valuable and it was an interesting approach to it, but it felt to me it felt foreign to me as a Brazilian watching it.
Yeah,
so.
Well, that was my feeling. It felt like, you know, California artists dropping in for 2 weeks going, oh, it's this and this and this. Whereas when I was watching Rio, I thought, wow, I'm really immersed in the whole ambiance and the culture of the geography and the city. It just was, to me, it was like night and day, because one was sort of lightly over, and that was what it was. It was a short, but and your thing, I really felt like I was there.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted. I didn't want to make a movie that I would just be a postcard of Rio. I wanted a movie that people could feel that they were in there. They, you know, take through the audience eyes and get them to feel a little bit that some of the things that I feel when I'm there. Of course, like, there are many Rios to portray in a movie. That's not that just what I did, but that's the choice that I made for what I consider to be my Rio, the Rio that I, you know, being a foreigner and being now, in a way, a person that's been living abroad away from Rio for such a long time. It's something that I wanted to convey in the movie. Something like, you know, is that feeling when every time I come back to Rio after being a while away, that first few days of that, you know, taking the city in and, you know, noticing the things that you kind of take for granted, noting the things that you kind of like tend to not remember anymore, and all some of that comes into your mind, and that becomes part of your life. You know, that's what I was trying to get people to feel. In a way, it was the journey of the character as well.
Right.
The character came into Rio for, like, in a way, as a first-timer, in a way, even though he was, in a way, portrayed as being taken away from that world, like, early on. He came in as being a foreigner, you know.
Can you sort of get into that mindset being as how you've been away for so long, when you go back, do you look at the city with different eyes?
I do. I know. It's funny. In the beginning, nowadays I go back much more often, so it's not as impactful as it used to be. Like before, I would go maybe once a year, and I remember being a year away, especially, and I would go usually during the holidays, which the contrast is gigantic, you know, from the cold of the winter in New York all the way to the peak of the summer in Brazil. I always loved that contrast. I always loved leaving New York with like the snowy and kind of like with jackets and all, and arriving in Rio and taking everything off and just like venture into that, like, you know, warmth. And so I wanted to be that. I wanted to be exactly that kind of feeling. And also arriving in Rio, like, you know, usually in the winter in the U.S. or in the Nordic countries, like the light is like dimmer, there's less foliage, like it's less lush, it's a little colder, grayer.
Yeah.
And then
when
you arrive, the shock of color. I wanted that to be a part of the storytelling too, like that kind of contrast of color, that you arrive in this much more vibrant visually, you know, place, you know.
Well, I think that really translates. I mean, because when I was watching it, I thought, wow, great color saturation. I really got the feeling I was in the tropics.
Yeah, and I wanted to make that impactful. I wanted that transition to be almost like immediate when you arrive there, when you set your foot there, like the movie changed palette and then becomes this more colorful and vibrant, you know, palette all the way through it.
Well, you do that in spades. What I'd like to know is, take me through some of the development process, because you have this idea and you know, at some point the powers that be say, well, penguins are overdone.
Yeah.
So we're not going to go with the penguin washed up on the beach.
Let's go back a little bit. Like, for example, when the first genesis was like, I wanted to do a movie about this kind of like about Brazil. Definitely with birds, because I'm a bird lover.
Right.
And I think I wanted the conflict of the story to be about bird smuggling, because I think that would be something like about, you know, the nature, like how nature, the lush nature, can be destroyed or being like, damaged by the human action, you know, and I wanted to get that message there too. So those elements were like, you know, boiling in my head. And then back then, we were talking about like, I don't know, you know, early 2000s, when I started like to have the idea, like 2002 or 2001. There's something that happens in Brazil all the time, which is penguins, you know, wash up into the beaches, you know, in the, you know, summertime, because like they get stranded in one of those currents from like Antarctica, and they ended up in the shores of Rio. And it's funny, and it's common. Like once in a while you see surfers with like penguins swimming next to them. And I remember there was a problem that's starting to become more and more because of global warming and all that. So that was more news every year, and I was intrigued by that. And I said, well, that's great, because in a way the foreigner arriving into a place, and I imagine, what if he arrived into a place where the birds were not black and white the way he was and could fly, and they were colorful, and they could dance, they could sing. It's almost like, you know, the guy that comes from the cold with a cold heart arrives in a warm place and kind of in a way warms his heart out with the culture, with the friends and the people that he meets. So when he goes back to his land, he's a changed character. I think that's what I wanted to be at first.
Well, you still captured that.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's what I wanted. That's what the essence of the story. Then I played with the story of the penguin. It was great. I loved it. And then we had all these rare birds. There was a whole thing about the bird smuggling, and one of the birds was a macaw, a blue macaw that was the rarest of them all, was the last of its kind. It was all so. Those themes were there already in the beginning, but was through the perspective of the penguin. It was the true foreigner coming into Brazil and just like exploring that world.
Right.
And then, you know, as the story, then I had to put the story on the shelf for a little bit because I was doing Ice Age 2.
Yeah.
And then after Ice Age 2, I brought it back to life and I said, look, I have this idea. What if we continue to develop it? And Fox was excited about it. But then they said, look, there's only one catch. Like, you know, back, this is like now a little further in, and then there's a lot of movies in development with penguins. And they said, look, there's a lot of movies developing with penguins. Not that your story will compete with that movie, but it becomes not as unique as it could be, because
right,
you have such a unique set piece and a unique thematic. Why not think about other characters? And then at first, I was kind of like resistant to do it because I love the idea of the penguin. But then when I removed that element, I removed the character as a penguin, but I kept the essence that I wanted, in a way, a foreign character coming into the life of the locals, coming into the life of Rio and blending in and warming his heart into that process. And that's when one of the characters was the rare macaw. I was a female in the original story, and I said, well, what if I bring a male to that? Because with the penguin, I created this impossible love relationship between the penguin and the macaw that didn't go anywhere.
That's not gonna work.
So I said, why not come up with a pair for the macaw, and then I'll come up with a bigger story. And that's when, again, looking into doing a lot of research in terms of birds and all. I wanted a rare bird, so that helped me a lot, because already I had a macaw. And the macaws are rare, and then I thought about what if we make that kind of he has to come to meet the girl.
Is a blue macaw, is that actually a rare macaw?
Yeah, well, the one that I portray there, it's one of the branches of the blue macaws. It's called the Spix macaw, which is the rarest of them all.
Yeah.
So I tapped into that story, and there was back then there was also a real story, which was a macaw that was there was one in the wild, and they brought a male from the U.S. to Brazil. And to try to mate, but the story doesn't go very well at the end, because they both disappear, and they kind of, I think they got extinct afterwards.
Well, that's, you don't want to end with that.
And I was like, well, I don't like that, that end, but I like the idea of the idea of becoming, something that could be related to something that has in the nature, because when I designed all my characters and all my birds, I wanted them to have some kind of connection to the real world. I want birds. When we did research, all the birds that we have in the movie are coming off of birds that exist in the jungle, that we try to create species that are there, just to be even more true to what we're trying to do with the birds. So,
well, I think that opening that you have with the musical number is really a showstopper, because it just it really anchors the picture.
Yeah, and that element of it is I wanted to capture. Birds are colorful. They can sing. They can dance. It's hard to think about Brazil without thinking about music, about carnival. And also, the story was always about carnival. The story was always when the penguin arrived in Rio was during carnival. So
And
the way that they would escape the whole chaos of the bird smuggling and all that would be through the parade, because parade, you have people with feathers. They could blend in, and all those things that we did, that I grew up with. So so when we built the story, it was a lot of fun. And actually, we did a lot of research on the carnival, especially I'm the only Brazilian, the only person from Rio in the crew, so I had to we had to find a ways to get everybody to be on board and understand what I was trying to say.
Go down there and do a little research. I wanted to ask you about story development.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you basically cobbled together did you do the first pass of the script, and then they bring in somebody else? I'm familiar with a lot of the studios out here, but I want to know how in Blue Sky they do it. Do you basically do a beat board and then...
The way that we do it, I don't write per se, I can't write. So, but I can outline stuff. So usually what I do is we sit down with our creative team, we have a small group that we sit down, and then in this case, I had all the beats and the thoughts that I had, the ideas that I had in my head. We outline everything. We talk about all the set pieces and things that I had in my head. And then once I have something that I feel good about, that's when we bring writers in. And then we bring writers in, I pitch the story. We develop some visuals too, we develop some imagery that, that could support what I was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I prepare a full-blown presentation of what would be the movie that I want to, I take people through the entire movie through a couple of visuals and some, sketches and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, I just wondered if you sort of did a beat storyboard.
Yeah,
so
it starts
that
with beats, yeah, for sure.
And then you expand out to the script, and then do you hand it off to the board artist to develop? And all that stuff?
No, we do first like images and a couple of beat boards and stuff like that. And then we go to the writer and then we try to get a draft that will somewhat start getting into that structure. And usually the first draft is always very rough and very not much what the movie ended up being.
Right.
So it's kind of like an evolving process for us. Because what we do is, like, the first draft comes out, and then we do a few revisions, and then once we feel good about, you know, the draft is telling a little bit the structure, it has the characters that we wanted to have in the movie and all that, that's when we start to dissect it, you know, more in more details and give it to the story team to start to, you know, to board it and to see how the scene plays, you know?
Yeah, I just wondered if the visual storyboard crew gets involved in the creative process and fleshes things out. Do you break it into sequences and all of that good stuff?
Yeah, and then they definitely get involved. As soon as we have some kind of document or some kind of more solid like element of it, they come in, and then when they come in, it's like a new layer of the process because they will take the script to the next level. They will, like, you know, there are things in the script that we're going to realize that's not working. And they have to solve it, and then that's when they come in with their skills and with that creative side of it, and then the brainstorming and the collaboration allow us to reshape the scenes and create new scenes, create characters. So it's a very collaborative, like, back-and-forth project that the story team connected with the writer, with myself, and everybody on board. We try to work something in a way that the movie is always plusing itself as it gets further along.
So you're basically guiding the story process at this point, aren't you?
Because yeah, all the way from the get-go, all the way.
Right, and then you're building story reels, and then handing it out, and all that stuff.
There's stuff, you know, again, it's like the as we go through it, you know, there's a lot of great ideas that come through the story guys that I accept. There's some stuff that doesn't quite make sense for the movie that we probably trash, and then you know, so it's an evolving process, and then I'm every day, you know, it's an everyday thing. For 3 years we don't stop doing it, you know. We just every day we get together, we see what we got, and we try it. We cut, we put it together. We see if it works. We rewrite. We draw again. So it's a very constant process.
Did you lose any sequences that you were really in love with that thought, nah, this just doesn't work anymore?
Yeah, there was one that I, you know, of course there's a lot of evolution as we go through, but there was, as we get deeper into the, you know, the reels, that's one that I liked. It wasn't so much like its own sequence, it was part of another sequence, which was like when they arrive at the fruit market or the street market, Blue has experienced for the first time, like, eating a real fruit, you know, eating some of the tropical sweet little fruits like mangoes, papayas, and all that.
Yeah, not having the bird seed.
Exactly. But that scene made more sense originally when we had a scene in the beginning, too, that, you know, he was eating cereal. He was kind of like, you know, more, you know, processed kind of fruit kind of thing. And then
you still have the marshmallows and the hot chocolate.
Yeah, but that was sort of like, you know, not as deep as what we had originally. Originally, we had a whole thing about him, like, making breakfast and eating, like, cereal and you know, one of the fruit cereals and just getting the taste of the fruit through the cereal, not so much to the real thing.
Yeah.
And then when we went to the market, he tried the same fruits, but he tried like the real thing. So that was like a big, you know, learning, you know, something that was fun for me. I love that contrast. But
you had time element. You had to lose it.
We had to lose it, and you know, it was fine. You know, but who knows?
Yeah. And the last thing, I guess, since you've got to move on, working with the actors on the stage. How many times did you have them come back as the story evolved? And how many, because this came up with a director I was talking with at DreamWorks yesterday, that we were talking about the number of takes, because I know directors that do 30, 40, 50 takes. And this director I was talking to yesterday said, nah, he says, if I have 12 takes, that's plenty.
Well, yeah, 12 takes is a lot of takes, you know. You know, there are a couple of shots that we do more. But what happens more than takes itself, it's just more like as we change lines or if there's adjustments to the pages, we have to re-record it. So,
oh, yeah, yeah.
So what we do is usually we have about, for the main characters, we have about an average of like 10, 12 sessions with it. So it's
right.
Like half days, like 4 hours. That we do throughout the 2 or 3 years of the project, so it's quite a very spaced out time with the actors. But then it gets like leaner as we, you know, it gets like less hours as we get closer to the end, because then the only thing that we're doing is picking up a couple of like retakes and a couple of like, you know, changes in the dialogue. But, you know, but it's usually a very straightforward process, because like the first, usually it's like this, like we get the actor to be the character, and then we go to the first session with the actor, and it's like the first session is more for me to know the actor and the actor to know me and the project.
Right.
So usually it's more of like an exploratory, fun moment that we're trying to discover the character. And then so the first two or three sessions is pretty much you trying to really think about the character and just finding the character, seeing what we can do with it, and testing some of the lines, seeing if the script is working. And the actor also has some collaboration there too, because he can say, look, I don't say it like this. I usually prefer to do it like this, or I don't think this line is what I would do, but I could do this. So there's a lot of fun back and forth.
Right.
And the key for these moments is to make sure that you're not shut down to those great little moments that sometimes the actors ad lib into, they come up with in the middle of the process, that makes it feel so natural and so much fun. So that first like three sessions is a lot of that kind of fun exploration. And then once we get that and we go back to the shop and we put it into the cut, and then we see the character talking those lines, and we see it evolves too. Like we start to rewrite for the character, we start to rewrite for the actor, and we start to explore new fun ways to continue like plussing the movie that we're making. And then, so that's why I think that is usually about 10 sessions until we get it all done.
Yeah, okay. I just, because that's always something that struck me, because every director I've ever met has had so many different ways of working. Some of them like to have 30 different readings of the same line. Others want to do it three or four times and say, yeah, we've got it. Great. Let's move on. That's great. And
yeah, I don't have a number per se, but I think that, you know, it usually like, you know, I don't know, 10 takes. it's hard to number. Some takes are like the first time that the guy says it, it's right. And then you take it like three or four more times just to get like coverage.
Yeah.
But sometimes there's a line that's, you know, and sometimes it's not the actor's problem. Maybe it's sometimes when the line is problematic, like you have to you try many takes. And then after 12 takes or 15 takes, if you don't have that take, like you might have to rethink the line, you know, it might be the line.
Yeah, well, that's kind of my thinking. It's just, you know, sitting with a director that does 30 or 40 takes, and you get back and listen to him, you go, why did we have him do it that way? What were we thinking?
Yeah, and then we always come back to some of the lines, like, you know, sometimes what we do is, like, we do a few takes, and we take it back to the shop, and then we feel that the line is okay, but you could use more energy. And usually sometimes coming back to the line is not so much to change the acting that they put into the line, but it's almost to get the actor to put more energy. Because the other deceiving things, like when you're there in the set with the actor and then we're recording it, you're seeing his face, you're seeing their faces, you're seeing them acting, and you totally buy it. But then when you extract that element of the visual and just have the line by itself for animation, you almost always wish that was a little stronger, bigger, or, you know, more powerful.
Yeah.
So, just because it's animation. So what we ended up, more than anything, most of my notes might be just like, you know, make it bigger, make it more, just, you know, you did it right. Now try to, you know, crank it up a little bit more and see what happens, you know, push it a little bit. So it's almost trying to push beyond what you naturally would do in a live action set, just to see if that gives you more spark, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And then when are you picking the voice takes? Are you picking them later back in your office with an animator, with by yourself? How does that work?
I usually do that with the editor. I sit down with the editor, and then we go through all the takes. And, you know, and sometimes the take is not, we use many takes to create one take. So
we
splice and move things here. We use some from here, something from there. So there's a lot of fun, you know, exploration until we build what the take would be. And then we do usually, we pick like two or three takes that we like the best. If I know one that I really love, and that's the one that stays, but if I have questions about it, I might bring my senior animators or some people that I trust creatively that could take a listen to it and help me see which one would sound best if we had to do, you know, if we had to animate this way, or, you know. So there's a lot, you know, I try to narrow down to what I think where my options are, and then, like, if I need help, I'll bring my key creative people to help me out.
You bring your leads in.
Yeah, because they're very good. good. Like, they, you know, they have an unbiased approach. They will listen and they give an instant reaction. For me, I saw the actors doing it. I worked with the actors. I listened to the line 20 times. You kind of lose perspective a little bit. And sometimes it's good to bring somebody from the outside to help you find again that perspective. Or, you know, we keep saying, like, you know, once, if you always remember your first instinct. If you liked it the first time, you should, there's something there that you liked. Trust that and keep it, because sometimes it gets diluted by the many takes you do, and or the many times you're listening to the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that makes sense. Now here's my since you're a native Brazilian, Brazil, you speak Portuguese, right?
Yes, yes.
So, were you involved in the actors that were doing the Portuguese translations?
Not directly. What I did for Brazil is, like, in a way, I listened to some of the actors that they were choosing. And usually the dubbing process in all the countries are, they have their own team, and they, it's such a professional thing that they do that I'm not, I don't think it's, I have the knowledge enough to help them. I just don't want to be another, you know, burden, so I trust that they do. They usually do a great job, because dubbing is such a profession outside the U.S. That's such a big thing. Because it's very common to dub movies abroad.
Oh yeah, no, I understand that.
And in Brazil, they were kind enough to send me like the voice that they thought, and I thought that they picked amazing voices there that, you know, carried a lot of the accent of the characters. Because, you know, when we did the movie here, we had like people with many different accents and things doing the movie for the English version of it.
Right, right.
But in the Portuguese, they managed to gather everybody from the same look, you know, everybody from Rio, so that you have the same accent. So it felt like, so the people there felt that the characters belonged in the place where they are, so it was very well received by Brazilians there, because they picked the right accent for the characters.
So you had a lot of input into the casting for the English, but not for the Portuguese.
Yeah, for the Portuguese, they send me the their favorites, and I listened to them, and I just gave them the okay, the ones that I liked, and
oh, okay, so you did have input in the casting.
Yeah, I had some input, but not a major, like, not like here. Here, we worked with the actors, and because we record the voices first, and then we animate it, so it's definitely way more. There is, like, they have to dub over what was already done, so
they've got a loop.
They have to get a good person that has the right voice, and also a person that knows the process of dubbing, which is a tricky one.
Yeah, getting on the looping stage and
exactly.
Going at
so there's
it.
A whole, you know, art there that they know better than I do.
Yeah. So you probably weren't involved with French, German, all the others.
No.
Mm-mm. At all. So that just because I was thinking, you know, Portuguese is your native language, and you're basically doing your story, so I would think you'd have some input into the...
Yeah, the only thing that I told them, like, you know, since it's going to be dubbed in Portuguese, make sure that it has the right accents and has the right location, so the movie felt right to what it is, you know, so it felt like a movie in Rio, you know?
Yeah, well, so the Brazilian translation dub, that goes in Portugal as well, doesn't it? They don't do a separate...
I think they might do a separate one. I don't know for sure, but usually sometimes in Portugal, they have to do their own thing. Because,
really?
You know, they try to make sure they use the slangs and the more local slangs.
Really?
For that, yeah.
That's interesting. I would have thought they would have said, okay, what goes for Brazil goes for Portugal, but...
Yeah, not always, you know, not always. So I don't know how they dealt with, but, you know, they might have done a hybrid, you know, because sometimes, like, the accent could be tough, you know.
And so, how long did it take you to cast the voices that basically everybody was animating off of, Anne Hathaway and Jesse Eisenberg?
Well, that takes about 6 months, I think, 6 months to a year. Because we start early, we start when we're starting to have the idea or the script. We have a first draft of the script. When we have the script in a shape that it could be shared, that's when we start casting. And it could take like as early as 3 months to get an actor, but, you know, sometimes some deals like can only be done like in 6 months. So it's about 6 months, I would say.
Did you have people come in and read, or was it basically you were going to go with this actor and that actor? No,
pretty much we did that. We knew we do a lot of testing. What we do is, like, once we have our short list of characters, we try to grab as much voice that we can gather from movies that they've done before.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then we try, based off of that, we do some animation tests, we listen to them, and then so when we come into them, we kind of know what we're looking for.
Yeah.
So they come in and they do it, and then usually so far it's been fine. That process has been working out good.
Okay.
Well, I think we have covered. Is there anything else that I haven't hit here that you want to?
Let's see. One of the fun parts of this, it was that as we animate or create the characters or create the personalities, one fun thing of it is just because it's done with birds and macaws and all that. Like, we did a lot of fun research. Like, we brought in people that were bird experts. We talked to them, and we brought birds into the studio so we can study their movements, we can study their personalities, and that helped us a lot, carving out a lot of things. For example, we brought in this lady that was like a bird expert, especially, she brought in cockatoos and stuff, and we keep talking like, so what are cockatoos like? What is the difference between a cockatoo in the wild and a cockatoo in captivity? Because we had a Nigel, which was a villain, was a cockatoo, and right. I wanted to come up with some fun stuff. And then as we're talking about the eating habits, she was saying that, cockatoos also like to eat eggs and chicken, And I thought that there was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I never thought that a bird would eat chicken, And she said, no, they in captivity, they do. They, you put little pieces of, cooked chicken, and they eat it. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. And then I ended up, putting him in the movie.
Right, he's a cannibal.
He's a cannibal. So those things are fun, As you go through the process, a lot of things get discovered in the process. So it's not always 100% set in stone, as you start. You always discover things as more collaborative people come on board.
So what I know that you're probably going to be into the next Ice Age, although you're not directing the next one, right?
No, not. Because the Ice Age 4 was happening at the same time as Rio was happening, so I had to detach myself. Because I was actually, Rio started when I was finishing Ice Age 3, and I was directing Ice Age 3, so
right.
It was kind of like a crazy time to juggle the two. So when Ice Age 3 ended, I said, okay, I have to focus just on Rio. I cannot have two projects. And that's when Ice Age 4 kicked in, and then I was, but it's in very good hands. Like, a lot of the crew is the same, and the directors are, I worked with them before. They're amazing, and they worked on the Ice Age movies again as well. So it was in good hands, so I didn't have to worry too much about that.
Well, do you know what your next project's going to be then?
Well, we're working into
around?
Future ideas. With the success of Rio, there's always the talk about continuing, and so we're tapping to that possibility. But nothing is really set in stone right now. And I also have we bought the rights for Ferdinand the Bull.
Oh wow!
The book, and
that's
I
right.
love that book, and we're thinking about that as well. But the good thing about it, the next movie is not mine, which is Ice Age 4, which is coming out this year. The movie after that is Chris Wedge's movie. So I have a couple of years just to really try to tap into what I some ideas there to explore.
Are you going to be taking some time off after the?
Well, I'm done with my time off. As soon as the movie was done, I took my time off. So now new year. Back to work and full force, and no time to rest anymore. Just go for it.
So back to Greenwich.
Back to Greenwich and working hard again.
Yeah, I came through the studio when it was at White Plains there on Broadway. I liked it.
I liked it a lot. I missed some elements of that studio that I miss. The location is definitely one of them. Now we're a little more isolated, but the place is definitely much better that we have now. So
you
can come over again.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
I'm really glad that you took this time, and I'm glad that we were able to connect.
That's great. Thank you very much.
We'll do it again for your next one.
Hope so.
All right.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.